The Unshackled Waves, episode 246.
Broadcasting from Melbourne, Australia, this is The Unshackled Waves with Tim Wills, brought to you by theunshackled.net.
Hello everyone, welcome to another Waves episode. At The Unshackled, as part of our continuous expansion, we've welcomed aboard a few new contributors. One of them is Aidan Green, who also operates the Commentariat, where he produces commentary videos and articles about current global events with a particular focus on the Trump era in the United States. He studied international relations at university and has also traveled widely around the world. He has also worked in the mainstream media, so he has had quite the life experience at such a young age. I thought it was about time to introduce him to you properly and have him on the show. Aidan, welcome to the show and welcome to The Unshackled.
Thanks for having me on, Tim.
Now, your main area of interest in news is international affairs. Now, I just wanted to start by asking, did this develop when you were young or at university? Where did sort of this fascination come from?
Probably not when I was young. I think it developed more. So when I was 18, I moved over to England to play cricket and I stayed there for 2 years. And then I came back and from there I kind of developed a bit of a travel bug. And then I decided to move to Canada for 2 years. And I think that's around the time of when I was 21 was when I started to start getting a bit more into politics and culture and the world that we live in. And then so I spent 2 years there, and then after those 4 years of travel I decided to then start university and then actually take on international relations and international studies at territory level.
So when you were young, it's fair to say you were just more interested in gaining life experience. You traveled widely. You mentioned England. Where else have you traveled to?
I've traveled to every continent in the world, about maybe 40 countries total. But I also lived in France when I did exchange in 2017, so about 2 years ago now, which was fantastic. Yeah, I think it's important to travel. I think it really makes you realize a lot about yourself and a lot about the people around you and just how, I don't know, I guess we're kind of insignificant in a way, but as a collective, we're definitely not. Yeah.
Because believe it or not, I've only ever been in Australia and New Zealand, which are similar countries. I've never gone on that sort of life journey overseas, but I see it every day on the news, what's happening over there, what are the issues there. But what did you observe on the ground in those countries? Is it a different sort of culture and sort of way of seeing the world?
Yeah, definitely. I think it depends on which country you travel in, which you're in, because all cultures are a little bit different there. I think France, for instance, their politics was a lot different to England and Canada. Canada was similarly polarized to America, with their left and right, Republican, Democrat. But with France, it was very much like a socialist democratic state, lots of protests, everyone involved, totally different to England. But I think one thing you do gather from traveling to all these nations and living in these nations is that everyone's really kind of pissed off, I think, with politics just in general. And everyone, it's just really common that people feel disenfranchised with politics, and especially politicians. But I think I try and tell people to maybe not be so against politicians, and more it's the system itself, I think, that is broken. Because a lot of these politicians are actually, you know, doing a lot of work and a lot of public service, and they genuinely want to help.
I'd probably disagree with that myself. I mean, if a politician wants to make a positive change that the people want, they can. The way our system is set up is the majority plus one gets to make the laws and set the policy direction. And so I definitely feel that we've been more let down by our leaders in the Western world, especially in Europe.
I guess it depends. I think in Australia you have it's just Labor or Liberal, so it's basically Liberal. So it's basically we almost just have one government. Whereas in Europe you do actually have the chance to push through either left wing, right wing, far right, far left, socialist. You can pretty much you do have a stake in the claim with the way that their systems work. I think in France they have about nine really strong politicians debating for at least a week, and then that gets cut down to five, and then it goes from five, and then it goes to two, and anything can happen in European politics. So I think you do have that sort of freedom for anything to happen in those places. But in Australia, I don't feel that way at all. I think if you're not in the mainstream political realm, then you don't have a chance.
Yeah, with Australia, it's because we've got a parliamentary system with single member electorates. That means that we're used to one of the major two parties having a majority at least in the lower house, and the best minor parties can do to break through is in the Senate. But as we've seen with every sort of minor party which everyone thinks is going to be big, it always implodes with the new MPs, getting a big head and sort of leaving and going out on their own, and then by the end of the term in Parliament, it's fallen apart.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I think one of the only reasons that people really vote for smaller parties in Australia is knowing that they might put a bit of influence. I myself, I usually vote for minor parties, knowing that they won't get in. But just because I think they might actually have a bit of influence on Labor or Liberal, whoever's in power. Yeah.
Now, as you mentioned, you went to university later on. You went to the University of Wollongong. Now, everyone sort of claims that their university is the worst, but it's sort of it's, they're all pretty much the same. I've sort of heard a few stories about sort of activism at the University of Wollongong.
Yeah, I think University of Wollongong is actually one of those universities that actually say they're the best. They don't really go around saying they're the worst. They definitely have a heck of a lot of activism, which is, not it's good to see that people are involved, especially in political terms. But yeah, Wollongong definitely has they definitely do have a lot of pride for their university. It's probably it's the staple for probably Wollongong itself now. It's now the leading economic producer ahead of the coal terminal and BHP and things like that, because it used to be such a labor, working class city. So much so that you don't even Liberal doesn't even contest down here. It's just out of Labor and the Greens.
Yeah, the two seats there, Whitlam and Cunningham, they're just such safe Labor seats. And it's interesting that you mentioned the sort of coal heavy industry in Wollongong and the Illawarra, despite Labor embracing the climate change agenda and wanting to phase out coal, people of Wollongong still voting Labor.
Yeah, it is interesting. I personally think that Wollongong would probably be a lot better if Liberal did some contesting down here, because then at least you'd get a bit of push for something different or a bit more initiative and activism from Liberal down here to actually create, like, make them do more, because it is such a safe seat. We probably do get left behind, but it's still we're still doing pretty well. It's still a great city. I'm proud to say I'm from Wollongong for sure.
Now, the University of Wollongong, they tried to they were looking at introducing or setting up a Ramsey Center for Western Civilization, which is this bequest set up trying to get Western civilization courses at Australian universities. They've tried at a few universities with no success so far. It's always the local academics and activists, claim that, this degree is, racist and, white history, and the same thing happened at Wollongong.
Yeah, it absolutely did. And I think the only reason it got through is because our vice chancellor fast-tracked it at the middle of the night when he knew that a lot of the academics that were 100% going to oppress the idea. He pushed it straight through, and it is going ahead. It's gonna, I think it starts in 2020. But there's been a lot of backlash from it. There's been protests. It's been all over the news. I wrote an article about it, and it went quite viral. So yeah, it's a lot going on. It's a big story for the little town of Wollongong.
Yeah, well, it's good that it's finally found a home, and it shouldn't be controversial to study, because we are here today because of Western civilization, but the left who control most of the universities believe that it's the birthplace Western civilization of all oppression and violence and bloodshed, even though that the peace and the standard of living that we enjoy today is because of Western civilization. The places that don't have Western civilization, Africa and the Middle East, that's where human rights aren't respected and where there's still civil wars.
Well, yeah, that's 100% correct, and I think that's basically what I touched on in my article. And I myself copped a lot of backlash for literally just stating facts about how women's rights are the highest in Western civilization, so as minorities, and the Western invented the scientific method, the abolition of slavery. The West, we have a lot to be proud of, and yeah, like you said, it's not a controversial thing to say that we appreciate the world that we live in and that we've grown up in. But going on from that, I posted the article on it on a UAW buy and sell site, full of obviously full of a left-wing crowd, and the amount of hate that I copped was quite funny. I think it got up to about 100 comments, but it only reiterated my point and made it quite clear that that the universities are left-wing, and it only proved my point further, really.
What was it like in the classroom itself? Because obviously some conservative right-wing students, especially in the humanities, find it difficult to sort of speak up about their views in the classroom because they don't want to get marked down by the lecturer or shouted down by their fellow classmates.
Oh, absolutely. I think maybe because I was a bit older, and because I did have so many years living in the West, that I was quite happy with, kind of standing up for the West, or just not going along with the politically correct narrative that we would all sit there and say, talk about post-colonialism or identity politics and the postmodern narrative. I would just, yeah, you would. It would be awkward because they're probably out of a class of, 20 politics students. There probably only would be two or three that were conservative or even considered conservative thought. And the lecturers themselves, I think I only came across one or maybe a two that you would think. I'm not quite sure where he leans on the political spectrum, whereas most lecturers were just far, so left-wing that if you even questioned it or answered it, you'd get scoffs or eye rolls and things like that.
Yeah, well, that's not too bad, but yeah, it's sort of the standard and sadly what's to be expected.
Yeah, and I think this is why the Ramsey degree is quite important, because it's going to just balance out political speech a bit more and balance out the thought process, because it is completely dominated, and it's not just Australia, it's all Western nations. And then Jordan Peterson's spoken about this for, well, I don't know, 10, 20 years, and now he's actually opening up his own university because of it. So, you know, when you block out conservative speech for so long and you block out conservative thought, other universities will emerge and other think tanks emerge, and it's what we're seeing now. And you could even go further with that with what Facebook's doing and the rise of other social media platforms. When you just silence people, that people don't remain silent, they go and find other avenues to say their speech. And it's not even the controversial speech, it's something that we need, you know. It's not like everyone votes left wing. It's not like we just have left wing parties. The silent majority, you know, actually owns the realm of politics when it goes to the voting, when it goes to the polls.
Yeah, look at all the recent elections in the US, yeah. Australia, and the UK. I mean, the conservative movement has always won, and it's always come as, you know, a big shock to the media and the cultural class, but, you know, despite all of this, like, indoctrination and, you know, preaching at and, you know, finger wagging, people, when they get into the ballot box, they still believe that, you know, right-wing parties are the most, you know, responsible to deliver economic stability and social cohesion.
Yeah, I think a lot of the younger people are more focused on disappearing nice, or, you know, it's a competition of who can have more moral standards or who can virtue signal the highest. But when it comes down to voting at the polls, people end up just voting conservative most of the time.
Well, one of the greatest examples of that was the election of Donald Trump as president in 2016. That the Trump phenomenon was one of the things that motivated me to start The Unshackled, because I was, before he came along, quite disillusioned with politics. But then, you know, Trump came along and he was just putting the establishment to shame. And yeah, it was like, I came to the conclusion that you just need to tear the political establishment down, and it was just, you know, hugely entertaining. And of course, when he won, that was the mass triggering from the left and the Not My President rallies. And what was your initial thoughts when he ran for president, and sort of how did you observe it as it gained steam, the Trump phenomena?
I think I was maybe a bit blind like everyone else. I think back then I was probably still believing in the mainstream media, but I always had in the back of my head Brexit. That was kind of the first shattering of the anti-establishment movement that we see going on around the world. And then, yeah, he kind of just hung in there. He kept winning. He kept using quick wit. And I think one of the main things was, which I kind of liked about him, was the fact that he wasn't a politician. And what I found, everyone was saying, oh, you know, like, I'm so sick of politicians. You know, I'm so over him. I don't want to vote for him. I don't trust him. And then Donald Trump comes along, who isn't a politician, doesn't act like a politician, and then gets voted in, and then everyone just hates him. Like, you just can't please some people, I think, at the end of the day.
Now, everyone was predicting when Donald Trump got elected president that it'd be a disaster for America, the economy would implode, that he'd be impeached within 6 months. But it's over 2 years on now, and the US economy has never been stronger, and every time the media have tried to predict the end of the Trump presidency, or this is definitely going to be the beginning of the end now, it's the media that cried wolf. And you've done a few videos, like, rationally analyzing his presidency, and, you know, basically he's been able to fulfill most of his promises and also manage the United States government and economy quite well.
Yeah, absolutely. I think when you actually look at him objectively and put all the bullshit aside, you actually find that he's doing incredibly well. I think it was unemployment's at 3.3 3.7%, which is the lowest in 50 years. Female unemployment was down to 60, the lowest in 65 years. African American unemployment was the lowest, I think, ever, like ever on record. Asian and Hispanic was also the lowest ever on record. So the whole country is doing better. Minorities are doing better. There's no impeachment. There's no impeachment coming. He's definitely going to get voted in again in 2020. So I'm really interested to see what actually does happen with mainstream media and the left when we're going on into that, you know, fourth, fifth, sixth year of Trump. Are they really going to be peddling conspiracies? And I think the other day it came out that they were pushing that how he was a fraud that lost $1 billion back in the 90s. But that's something that they're clutching at straws, and it's getting quite embarrassing, really.
When Trump was running for president, there was a whole lot of Republicans who were never Trumpers. They thought Trump was a menace to the Republican Party, but now he's got an 80% approval rating among registered Republicans, and all the polling is indicating that he's doing much better than other presidents during their first term in office. And there's a Melbourne Cup field of Democrats who want to run against Trump, and most of them are the intersectionality candidates, because that's who's taken over the Democratic Party. But it's quite ironic that the front runners, Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, are old white men, supposedly the enemies of progressivism.
Actually, that's a pretty good point. I didn't really think of it like that. I guess that is just the hypocrisy of the left in itself, right there. I do think if Bernie Sanders, I think Bernie Sanders was the only person that really has a chance, because he was quite anti-establishment. And I feel that when back in the election, when Trump was running against the Democrats, the moment when which was Hillary's downfall, was not making Bernie Sanders her vice president. And then I think a lot of those anti-establishment voters that were going to Bernie Sanders kind of said, oh, stuff this, I'm gonna go and vote for Trump. And now that Trump's doing well, the Democrat Party is just in that, it looks like they're in absolute disarray. There's probably only, I mean, maybe even AOC is acting like a, I don't know, just making a complete mockery of herself.
Yeah, I mean, they did win the House of Representatives, the Democrats, in the midterms. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, you know, the future of the Democratic Party with a Green New Deal, and the fact that she says things like, oh, it's not important to be factual, you only just have to be moral, and the fact that she sounds like just so stupid. And actually it makes like the old guard, like Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, actually look, you know, more level-headed.
Oh, absolutely. And she just plays way too much into identity politics. I think I saw a video the other day of her speaking in I think Brooklyn it was, in front of a majority African-American crowd, and she totally changed her accent, sounded as if she was a black person, which is just the epitome of patronization. And if Donald Trump went and did that to an African-American crowd, you could just imagine the absolute uproar. But just because it's coming from the left, it's acceptable.
Yeah, I recall Hillary did that as well.
Yes, yeah, she did. I featured it in one of my videos.
Yeah, it just goes to show that it's the left who, like, they're the real purveyors of racism. Like, they're the ones who see people as, you know, all members of different tribes who need to be treated differently.
Yeah, well, that's exactly right. They see everything through a lens, and then whilst you're looking through that lens, it's like, well, my lens says that you have to think this way, or you have to behave this way, or you have to vote this way. And luckily we do have things like Blegs that are actually kind of shattering the politically correct narrative and the breaking the shackles of the way that people think, and the simulation of fear that is instilled by the left, and it could actually happen. Blexit, the removal of African Americans from the Democratic Party, moving over to the Republican Party and voting. I think he received 40% in a Rasmussen poll in October, just last year, which is the highest ever by a Republican president in the history of the nation, and that is absolutely remarkable. Like, in terms of anything, that is remarkable, but you would not hear it on the mainstream news. You will not find it in a newspaper. You'll only find it on the internet.
Well, Donald Trump, he's not a racist. He never has been. I mean, when he was a celebrity businessman, like, he used to associate with black celebrities all the time. He's had heaps of, like, black senior executives at his Trump organizations. There's absolutely no evidence for that. It's just the usual, you know, hysteria that, or, you know, because he wants, you know, strong borders, a border wall, that he must be a racist.
I think that's one thing that the left doesn't realize, is that patriotism doesn't see any color, but the left truly does. And going on from Trump not being seen as a racist, he featured in 67 chart-topping hip-hop hits before he was president. So he was absolutely praised by African Americans before he ran for presidency. So I don't know why they would praise a racist.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't just magically become racist when you're a Republican.
Yeah.
And of course, the main thing they've tried to get him on the media is the Russian collusion thing. And we had the Mueller special counsel investigation, which, you know, found, you know, no collusion, no obstruction of justice. Like, there was never anything. The only thing they sort of found was, you know, like, associates of his had spoken to people who were connected to the Russian government, which would happen in political circles all the time.
Yeah, like, nothing that was out of the ordinary. And if you put a lens on, well, if you actually investigated Hillary as hard as you just investigated Trump, you're going to find a hell of a lot more problems, you know? That's where crooked Hillary really comes into it.
But she still hasn't been. The two promises that Donald Trump hasn't fulfilled is the border wall and locking Hillary Clinton up.
Yeah, I think locking Hillary Clinton up would be quite difficult. The border wall is underway. Parts of it is happening. But there's, now that the House of Reps is majority Democrat, it's going to be quite difficult to get funding.
Yeah. And his biggest cheerleader, Ann Coulter, she's saying that if the border wall's not built, the Trump presidency will have been just a joke.
Yeah, Ann Coulter says a lot of things.
Well, probably the other big climactic geopolitical event of the past few years has been Brexit. That was sort of the first event which sort of showed that the right was on the resurgence. But it's 3 years on and Brexit hasn't been delivered. Well, Theresa May, she's now going to resign because she hasn't been able to deliver it. That just shows that the left, they can still do their best to stifle the will of the people, even if it is a democratic vote.
Yeah, it's quite bizarre that what the left can get away with compared to the right itself. I was actually in England when UKIP got its first seat back in 2012, and that was that at the time was massive news. That the right was kind of coming, you know, that resurgence. It happened way back in 2012 when they won that seat, and then move on. Where are we now? 2019, you have Brexit. 2019, you have UKIP has several, you know, several seats in Parliament, and then a Brexit party that's only been around for 6 weeks comes in and completely shatters the MEP elections for the European Union. So. It looks like Brexit is definitely going ahead, and Marine Le Pen of France was voted in as well. So France will probably Frexit. Italy will probably go as well. And the European will probably be obsolete in just a few years, I think.
Now, we're both in the alternative media, and we've done a lot of commentary on how the mainstream media, corporate legacy media is dying. You actually have had some work experience with the mainstream media. What was that like?
Yeah, I actually quite enjoyed it. It's a lot more on than... It still is the trusted, the fourth estate as we have it at the moment. Things are slowly changing. I think Fairfax recently just sold, I think, 6 or 7 papers in Australia. The Illawarra Mercury, one of them, they originally bought it something like a few billion, and they recently just sold it for only 300 million. So just the amount of money that is going... being taken away from newspapers and mainstream media is quite large. So I'm not sure where I will be in 10 years, but for the meantime, I have kind of chosen internet media just because it's a bit more freedom, and I can make my own videos and commentate on whatever I want and be my own boss. Risk, but I think they say with a lot more risk comes a lot more reward in the long run.
Yeah, I've haven't worked in the mainstream media, but I know like how it works is that, you know, when, you know, you're a journalist in a major corporation, you know, you're given assignments by the editor. You have to like cover what he instructs you to do. You can't really put your own spin on things. It's very much you're given a quota and you're just sort of churning it out.
Yeah, you definitely do have to pump out the articles, and you don't always get to decide what you want to write about. And you do have to obviously stay lines of the letterhead. And there is that underlining tone of, I think Fairfax is a little bit left and News Corp is a little bit right.
Mm.
You're never really going to go outside those lines. You're never really going to take any risks. Mainstream media takes absolutely no risks whatsoever. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing, that's up for debate. But yeah, I still had fun. I still enjoyed it for sure.
Yeah, I've noticed the two mainstream media journalists, they were with News Corp initially, Samantha Maiden and Peter Van Onselen, when they were quite sort of, they were right-leaning, but now that they've left, Peter Van Onselen's with Network 10 and Samantha Maiden's with The New Daily, which is a union-aligned online newspaper, they're now, all of their commentary is really hard to the left, and it's just it's just interesting that sort of they sort of, like, even though they are, like, good journalists, they still towed the sort of, like, corporate line.
I think all journalists, at the end of the day, I think money talks. I think if you tell anyone, any journalist, you know, you're going to have to write this way. I think with it being such a hard industry to get into and almost a dying art, there aren't too many journalists that do kind of take that independent route and do take the risk to go online and live off things like Patreon and donations in itself, because it is so risky. So, yeah, I guess some journalists do kind of sell their souls. Hmm.
Well, before the internet media age, newspapers could rely on all the revenue from the classifieds. Television could rely on all the ads from like the major corporations. It was they were your only options, like print or broadcast media. But with the internet and the fact that information could now be accessed for free, like you didn't have to pay a dollar for the newspaper every day, you could just go online. And so, and also with the Google and Facebook, they've basically consumed all of the online ads. I mean, most businesses now just advertise on those two platforms. And with the classifieds, now you have like all the jobs are on seek.com.au. There's other online classifieds that's just drained their revenue right down.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. They're just taking pretty much all the revenue, and that's why journalism is a dying art. That's why it's hard to make a bang for your buck online, because they are just taking everything right up against the top. But, you know, things are changing. I think we see a lot with the Facebook censorship that's going on a daily basis. This censorship of right-wing comments cannot really go on for too much longer. I'm surprised that it's even gone on this long. I'm surprised that mainstream media hasn't actually put its foot down yet and started to actually give everyday citizens this information, because a lot of people, a lot of my friends or just everyday person, they have no idea what is actually going on and the scale of how big this is in the history of human civilization. Like, we have never humans have never gone through something where a private entity has owned over 3 billion people's social media accounts and essentially decided that we're just going to be left wing. Like, we're only going to put out information that's left wing. Like, that we thought Stalin was doing bad, but this is on an even grander scale. And because they're doing it, because Silicon Valley's left, and because they think that hate speech is a real thing, or basically anything that they disagree with is being shut down, that it's okay, and it's not.
And the legacy media, now they're reliant on Facebook and Google for most of their traffic. I mean, it's such a so many people are on it now that now to, you know, remain competitive, these corporate media, they've got to have a major presence on the social media outlets. But the also, as I mentioned, the main problem is that now people with the internet, they're used to getting the news and information for free. They don't feel that they should pay for it, like through subscription, but that's the only way it's going to survive. If you want journalism, you're going to have to pay for it. Obviously, News Corporation, they've got a pretty strong paywall. I think all of their websites, except for news.com.au, is paywalled. Fairfax have, like on their websites, 30 free articles a month. It's sort of a bit more liberal than that, but it's that's going to have to be the model, sort of pay-per-view.
Yeah, it kind of looks like it is going that way. I really hope it doesn't, because people seem to be having less and less money every day, and the gap between the rich and the poor does actually seem to be getting only bigger. So I know that people like university students, for one, definitely aren't going to be paying for any information. Only people that can afford it will be paying for any free information. So then you're going to have a bit of an intellectual gap for, you know, in trusted journalism and actual information that you know is genuine and real and has actually been funded to actually go out and find that story. So I'm hoping that is not the way of the future. I'm hoping something else changes. Maybe a new platform emerges where everyone goes on that, and the ads that are generated are actually enough to fund journalism again. Because just the way that it's going at the moment, it's really hard to predict. And I actually don't think subscriptions is the answer. I can't see someone, even like myself, who reads every day, paying for several subscriptions from multiple sources. It doesn't make sense. Maybe we could have like a Netflix kind of thing where I can get, or, you know, New York Times on one, or Fairfax or News Corp and things like that on the other. But single-handed subscriptions, I don't think that's going to happen.
Going back to, you mentioned the deplatforming, because like a lot of YouTubers, they were able to get a lot of revenue from YouTube ads, but then there was the mass demonetization of their channels because of like controversial content. Like Lauren Southern's videos got demonetized, so did Rebel Media's, and so then everyone like sort of turned to Patreon, to which is a crowdfunding, what we're talking about, subscription based platform. But now Patreon and PayPal, they've joined the deplatforming movement, and so not only are right-wing and conservative people being like denied the ad revenue now, but now the even ability to get people to support them financially.
Yeah, I did not know that they actually not even allowing Patreon. That's fuck, that is absolutely bizarre that they're actually stopping someone from giving their money to a journalist. Is I don't know, it's beyond me.
Yeah,
I know
Sargon
it's
of
no
Akkad,
yeah.
he got banned from Patreon, so did Milo, Lauren Southern, Faith Goldie. There's a whole list of them.
Yeah, I think that just shows just how far, way too far the left have gone. When you actually, it kind of all is to do with Trump and the election of Trump back in 2016, that now they have so much hate for the right that they'll actually, companies now are actually deciding to be political. Like we see Nike doing it. We see Gillette being political. It's almost become normal that companies decide to be political, but I always imagine companies to be capitalists, and I can't imagine the YouTube boardroom and them sitting in that room and saying, "Oh, okay, guys, well, how can we make more money? Oh, I know, let's demonetize half of everyone's political thought." It's absolutely ludicrous, and it's one of the most bizarre things. It's actually quite fascinating, and I love learning about it, and I love writing about it because it really is so bizarre that they would actually put political thought over capitalism itself.
Well, we saw in Australia during the same-sex marriage postal survey, pretty much all the major corporations supported the Yes campaign. I don't think there was one that, dared say no. And like, there are also like all corporations have their corporate social responsibility. Like, they support, Indigenous constitutional recognition. Of course, the biggest one is, Qantas. They support pretty much all the progressive causes, and with this deplatforming by the major corporations, one wonders where it stops. Like, is a bank going to close down your account because they don't like your political views? Is a telco going to disconnect you because they don't like your views?
Well, that does happen, but I think I read one a satire article the other day. It was actually quite funny, and it kind of made put a bit of realization into just how far these things are going. It was, we need to continue to silence these commentators. We need to continue to throw milkshakes at them. And then the last sentence was, we in fact we need to start killing them. We need to actually start killing these people. Where do you draw the line? Like when you can't even buy things, and when you are absolutely segregated from society, what does happen? We're not far off an acid attack or an attack by Antifa that goes too far. Like it definitely could happen, and it probably will when once Trump gets re-elected in 2020.
Like, all the like lefties say, oh, it's just an egg, it's just a milkshake. But like, all these assaults are enabled, encouraged, excused, and so you're giving like inspiration for people to go further. And we saw like in the United States, a Republican congressman, Steve Scalise, he was shot at a baseball game. He was in a critical condition at like hospitals. So it has escalated from just an egg and a milkshake.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure a British politician was killed last year as well. So it does happen, and if we're excusing violence just because the left are doing it, then really, like, where are we getting our morals from?
Yeah, I definitely think we're at an important crossroads, but the internet is also it's a beacon of freedom. Like, they can censor all they want, but they can't unperson people online. There's free speech, social media. There's Minds, Gab, MeWe. There's all different alternatives. If you try to kick somebody off Facebook or something else, then something else pops up.
Yeah, that is the case. But at the moment, it's Facebook is the complete monopoly. It's become a utility. So until these other platforms do pick up, it really is. It's just a massive a breach of power, in my opinion.
Now, what do you see as the future trends? Obviously, in Australia, we just had a federal election where everyone was surprised that the coalition was re-elected. Labor took quite a far left agenda to the election, which was rejected. So far, they haven't indicated that they've learned anything. They've just blamed, vested interests and people didn't understand our great policies. Do you sort of see Australia, like, because I was concerned at the beginning of the year the direction that we were heading, but I've become a bit more measured in sort of my expectations.
I actually predicted Scott Morrison's victory. I think I read a few articles on it. Even when he was paying $4 months out, you just know that. I think there were several reasons why they lost it, but the main one was probably just the fact that the way that Australians vote, they don't really vote for the party. They actually vote for the preferred leader. And if you looked at the polls throughout, years before, it was Scott Morrison was always the preferred prime minister out of the two. People just did not like the way that Shorten carried on. They didn't like how awkward he was. They didn't like his zingers. He was just not seen as a leader. So that I predict, even when it was, I think it was eight, it got up to $8 in the morning of. Yeah, that's how out of. That's one way that you can see how out of touch the mainstream media is that he was paying $8 in the morning of Bill Shorten was paying $1.30, and bookies were paying out the win for Bill Shorten. It's
Yeah,
like,
I couldn't believe that.
who are these political pundits? Why do they still have a job?
I mean, all the commentators were predicting a Labor win. All the polls were as well. That was a big thing. The polls were all wrong.
Think the polls being wrong is it's quite common now. You'd almost have to predict your own poll on the poll being wrong.
Well, there's a lot of us on the right who've, like we mentioned, the betting markets have become quite wealthy over these shock results because we've always betted against what the commentators, bookmakers, and polls have said and won big.
Yeah, well, I think I had money on Donald Trump's win, and that was $4.50 in the morning of, and that was a crushing victory.
And obviously, you've said you believe that Trump's going to be re-elected. I certainly think that there's no inspiring Democrat candidate. I think the sort of big question is going to be where Europe goes, whether the new British Prime Minister will actually deliver a proper Brexit, and if that final eventuation, inspires nationalists on the European continent to sort of follow.
Yeah, no, I definitely do think the European Union will either be totally obsolete or quite different with more Eastern European nations because they've actually had to get nations to join the union because England's gonna Brexit. That's done and dusted. The latest vote for the MEPs with Brexit Party absolutely crushing it. They will be out, and Marine Le Pen winning in France and also Italy. Their latest election was a coalition of conservative and far right. So they're looking to Itelxit. So they're looking to get out. So that's they're arguably they're the three biggest economies in the European Union, other than Germany. So once they lose those large economies, we'll probably will see the end of this European Union experiment.
Yeah, oh, there's definitely, I feel, like I said before, that there's now, optimism and, excitement again about the future. There was quite a few people who were sort of black-pilled at the beginning of the year, but I think things have turned a corner now.
Well, yeah, absolutely. Like, I think protectionism, I've touched on it a few times, is actually one thing that environmentalists and lefties should actually be pushing towards. Brexit, there was a Brexit movement in the 80s that was actually led by a left-wing party. And this is what the people don't understand. Like, when you bring in protectionism and you stop, you just produce, you make domestic goods the predominant use for the economy and stop importing goods from all over the world. You actually stop a lot of carbon dioxide being emitted out into the earth. And then for, another result from that is if you're buying local goods, you're supporting local jobs, you're supporting the local economy, and it actually makes goods cheaper in the long run. Yes, your dollar may be a little bit weaker, but you'll be buying goods that are actually a lot cheaper, and that's what they're finding in England. And the world hasn't turned on its head, which they said would happen, and England's actually doing incredibly well.
Well, we'll keep doing our bit here in the alternative media. I'm looking forward to more of your commentary and videos and articles on the Unshackled. They've been quite a welcome addition to our growing platform.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I'm excited. I got a few great videos in the works and a lot of work to do in the future.
And we'll chat again soon.
Thanks, Tim.
And that's the show for today. As I've mentioned previously, I'm serving a 30-day ban on Facebook, so I'm not spending much time on the platform. So I'm investing more of my time on free speech social media, which The Unshackled has a growing presence on. We are on gab.ai/TheUnshackled. We also are on Minds at minds.com/the_unshackled. We also have a MeWe page at mewe.com/p/TheUnshackled. And we also have our growing Telegram channel on the encrypted messaging service at t.me/TheUnshackled. Remember that we rely on the financial support of you, our followers, to bring you all the content and news that we do. You can pledge over at patreon.com/theunshackled or directly via paypal.me/theunshackled. We also have our premium membership option on our website, theunshackled.net/support-options/premium-membership. And thank you to all those who continue to contribute on a regular basis. It all helps us. So thanks once again for your company, and we'll see you next show.
Thanks for tuning in to the Unshackled Waves. Please visit theunshackledwaves.net for all the ways to subscribe and follow the show. Don't forget to pick up your free ebook at theunshackledbattlefield.net and keep checking out theunshackled.net for all the latest news and commentary.